Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
This week we're going to talk about nuclear weapons, or more specifically about the development of the first atomic bomb way back in 1945 now. And I think that people don't spend a lot of time thinking about nuclear weapons in the history. They think about nuclear proliferation. They think about the dangers of Iran getting the bomb or something. But there is an incredible scientific story. And for most of us, I think, to the extent that we do think about it, we think about a bunch of scientists getting together in the desert in Arizona, in New Mexico, in Los Alamos, the Manhattan Project, and kind of finessing the bomb, building the bomb. And that's certainly true. But like most of these great stories, there's a fascinating backstory, which I think Americans aren't that familiar with. And so, you know, this is one that takes place mostly on the other side of the ocean in England, and which has kind of surprising protagonist, Winston Churchill. And so here to talk about that with is Graham Farmelo. Graham is the author of a fascinating new book, which has the title Churchill's Bomb, and it's subtitled How the United States Overtook Britain in the First Nuclear Arms Race. So welcome, Graham.
Oh, good to be here, David.
So thanks so much. So I think that, you know, as I said, people think about the bomb, to the extent they think about the history of the bomb, they don't think about England so much. They don't think about Churchill. You know, exactly what was Churchill's role? I know it's a complicated one, but how would you describe his role in the early days of research on how to build a nuclear weapon?
Churchill was the first international leader to have the notion of a nuclear bomb put on his desk, so to speak. It was British scientists who first hit on the idea of how to build a nuclear weapon. Now, the idea of atomic bombs, the words were first coined by H.G. Wells in 1914. That's 100 years ago, almost exactly a century ago as we speak. Those words were read, incidentally, almost certainly by Winston Churchill, who was an avid H.G. Wells reader. Now, much of the nuclear progress that eventually ended up being developed in the bomb was made at the University of Cambridge. And some great strides were made there by a great scientist called Ernest Rutherford and his younger colleagues. He called them his boys. Those strides were made in the 20s and 30s. Of course, there were work done elsewhere, but that was a particular centre. Now, it was around the time that Hitler was taking power in Germany that nuclear fission was discovered, and that was when the prospect of nuclear weapons first became palpable, so to speak. And it was only in March 1940 that two scientists working in Birmingham, actually classed as enemy aliens, hit on the idea of how to make a nuclear weapon. And in a couple of months later, those ideas were floating around Westminster, that's the government centre in London. And soon after he became Prime Minister, Churchill will have heard about this in his capacity as Britain's national leader in wartime.
Well, it's interesting. I think, and I was reading one of the reviews of your books, and it said that Churchill was too expensively educated to know anything about science. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I like the line. I like the line. I think it's a little unfair. It's certainly true that Churchill was not a good scientist, a trained scientist. That's certainly true. What is remarkable about him, I think, is that although he hated mathematics, he was terrified of it, and wasn't a particularly good scientist, he was nonetheless interested in it. I mean, when, as a subaltern in India, his father, remember, had said, well, he's never going to make it at university, there's no point in sending him there, Churchill decided to educate himself. And among the books he read was Charles Darwin's book of Origin of Species and A Plain Person's Guide to Physics. He knew that he had to know about science, and almost as soon as he became a member of Parliament, he started to acquaint himself with science that might be useful to the military. And his main source of that were the astonishingly far-sighted novels of H.G. Wells.
Yeah, he really did. It seems like if he didn't have the scientific knowledge, he had the foresight to realize that nuclear weapons and other kind of advanced military technologies were going to be very, very important in the And so tell me a bit about his relationship with H.G. Wells. You mentioned that before. I guess they spent time together socially as well as Churchill reading his books.
Yes, that's right. Churchill read all of H.G. Wells' books twice, not once, twice. And he, when he became a member of Parliament, he quickly sought after people of influence like Wells, who was a very hot novelist at that time in the UK and in the States too. And they met for the first time I think it was 1902. I may have got that year wrong, but it was certainly very early on in Churchill's time in Parliament. And they soon became really quite good buddies. They were in conversation with each other, and Wells later visited Churchill at his home. They were certainly people, although their politics were very different, they held each other in considerable respect. That's for certain.
And so how would this, it sounds as if in reading your book, it seems as if committees kind of took over as this idea of, or this research on nuclear fission became known. Suddenly or gradually, all the scientific committees kind of got slowed down by committees or something, interlocking committees. What happened to that?
I can't really quarrel with the idea that it entered committees, but I actually think this was to the credit of those scientists in Britain, in particular Rudolf Piles and Otto Frisch. Those were the two guys who first hit on the idea of how to make a nuclear bomb, of taking two pieces of pure uranium, a particular isotope of uranium, smashing them together and enabling them to go critical so that you might get a bomb. This was a terrifying prospect to them because they had both been in Europe, which was then grave danger being overrun by Hitler, and they were terrified that Hitler and his scientists would have that weapon.
Take us from that point when this discovery is made that fission could be possible. Take us to the point where, walk us through the steps that got England started on bomb work.
Yeah, well, those scientists, people often say, don't they? You know, scientists, they're playing God. They keep themselves to themselves. Well, this didn't happen with the bomb. As soon as those guys hit on this idea, they took. They wrote a wonderfully clear memo, you can read it online, called the Frisch-Piles Memorandum, a classic of science writing, that set out in plain person's terms how a bomb could be made and what its impact would be if it were dropped on, for example, a city. And they took that to the British government's apparatus, and as you rightly say, it went through committees. Now, those committees were there for a reason, because it was a very speculative idea. Britain had its empire had its back against the wall, and in order to make that bomb happen would be a huge investment at precisely the wrong time, so to speak, right? And yet the stakes were high, because like I said, if Hitler's scientists had got that weapon, then who knows what would have happened. Now, it was those committees that delivered to Prime Minister Churchill in the summer of 1941 the possibility of building a nuclear weapon. And that Churchill approved in a note that he was very, very proud of, saying he didn't really see the need for any more destructive explosives, but he didn't want to stand in the way of progress. So he approved the nuclear program in August 1941.
But did Churchill play his hand badly? Is that how you would couch the what happened with him? Did he play badly?
Well, let's just briefly look at that. Some of those British scientists were saying, look, there's no way we can build this bomb in Britain. The Nazis are bombing us. We're very vulnerable. We're heading towards something approaching bankruptcy. How on earth could we build a weapon like this? It's a huge, huge project. Surely the best thing to do is to collaborate with our American friends. And Frisch and Piles' boss, a gentleman by the name of Mark Oliphant, was campaigning in the United States among several scientists, and he actually met Robert Oppenheimer during that visit, to bring the United States into this. Now, in October 1941, President Roosevelt actually wrote to Churchill, and mentioned the possibility, or floated the possibility, of jointly conducting a nuclear bomb program. And Churchill didn't answer that memo for about, I think it was 7 weeks. And soon after that, the United States was in the war, and then they ran with the nuclear program, with Britain playing catch-up, so to speak. Now, in my judgment, Churchill was remiss at that juncture. He not only in not replying to that memo, but he actually took his eye off the ball. Because if you look at Churchill's correspondence, and I've done that in very great detail, he's really very slow to follow up on this. He only really gets going in April 1943. And it's very clear what you see in the archives. You see a Prime Minister who, of course, is extremely busy. Let's be clear about that. He wasn't right. just twiddling his thumbs, but he was extremely busy. He was not making any of the running in this. And then Roosevelt's colleagues were more or less giving him the runaround, saying, "Oh, don't worry, we'll talk eventually." He eventually lost his cool, so to speak, and said, "We really must get into this project." And that's when the Churchill of popular imagination, so to speak, the popular image of Churchill comes into play. Strong leader, commissioning reports, setting up committees, taking action very firmly. And it was that action that culminated in Churchill meeting Roosevelt to discuss the bomb in Quebec in August 1943. And that's how the British very belatedly got into the Manhattan Project.
And I think part of the problem for Churchill was that he didn't have the best scientific advisor, as you make clear in the book.
Yes, that's right. Well, you're rightly referring to a gentleman by the name of Frederick Lindemann, later known as Lord Charwell. Now, Lindemann was undoubtedly a good scientist. I mean, when he got his chair in Oxford in the early 1920s, he got great references from people like Rutherford, from the American scientist Millikan, and a host of others. He was a good, solid guy, but he was not the kind of person who made a lot of friends. He was very sharp-tongued, very sarcastic, very good friends to people close to him, whom he liked. But he would, if you were an enemy of his, then believe me, you knew it. So he made a lot of enemies in Whitehall and jealously guarded his access to Churchill's ear, so to speak. And Lindemann, he had his qualities. He was a brilliant summariser of difficult problems. That's not in doubt. And people knew that. He was a great communicator. But he was not well connected with the nuclear community. And he was capable of some very wayward judgment. For example, early on really did think it was Britain should make a run to build the bomb on its own soil, or, as he put it, at worst in Canada.
Right.
You said that. I think that was Churchill's most serious error. He knew that he needed science. He got some value out of Lindemann, but he put far too much trust on Lindemann's shoulders.
Well, talk a bit about Britain's involvement in the Manhattan Project.
Well, in the end, it was relatively small in terms of numbers. It was about 24 British scientists had a role on that project. Now, the project was gargantuan, right? And Britain barely put a cent into a multi-billion-dollar project, but it did put some first-rate scientists, including Frisch and Pyles. Remember, I mentioned earlier that right. they hit on the first idea of how to build a nuclear weapon, and several other people who made key contributions. But it wouldn't be it really would be ridiculous to say that this was a major contribution to the Manhattan Project in the sense of proportionate to the gigantic contribution that America made. My point is that if Churchill had played his hand better, then the understanding at the beginning would have been much more sound. And after the war, when Britain was completely sidelined, and had to basically make its own way, that would never have happened. That was a deeply hurtful thing to the British scientists and pretty shocking to the British politicians when they were basically abandoned after the war. I don't think that would have happened if Churchill had played his hand better.
Well, one way in which he may not have played his hand the best way was, I think, in a meeting with Roosevelt. They agreed to share work on the bomb, and then but that was never formalized.
Yes, that's absolutely right. In Quebec in August 1943, they did sign that agreement, and Churchill was very proud of this. He, as far as he was concerned, that sealed the deal. From another point of view, it was a very shaky agreement. It wasn't particularly well worded, although it had been drafted by one of Churchill's most senior assistants, so to speak, Sir John Anderson. And it, for example, what it did was it gave Britain and America the veto. They both had to sign any use of the bomb, and it really did give a lot of say in each other's policies, so to speak. Something that would have, I think, most other people, I believe, would not have gone down well either in the House of Commons, but in particular on Capitol Hill. You see, Churchill and Roosevelt treated the bomb as a kind of personal fiefdom. Mm. They treated it as their own private deal. Roosevelt did not tell his deputy, Truman, who later succeeded him to power, about the project in any detail at all. Likewise, Churchill, his trusted deputy, Attlee, barely had a clue about what was going on. So that was the extent to which they kept it to themselves. But when Churchill was thrown out of office at the end of the war, Roosevelt tragically died relatively shortly before the end of the war, two greenhorns were in there running the policy with Stalin across the other side of the table.
Right. Well, there's a tremendous amount of paranoia affecting everybody, right? The arms race was already being foreseen.
Yes.
And to what extent was Churchill driven by paranoia about the Germans in the years leading up to World War II? The fear that they had that they were already farther ahead on working on a bomb.
You mean leading up to, you say, the Second World War?
Second World War, yes.
Well, let's be clear. The general picture that Churchill foresaw that Britain was not well equipped to deal with a Nazi onslaught from the air. He later said that he did over-egg that case, but nonetheless, it is true that he was with one or two other people a visionary, in that he was right to bang that drum, because he was certainly very worried about Germany's intent beforehand. Later towards the end of the war, Churchill would you have to feel sorry for the guy. He felt disillusioned because he saw Hitler and Germany fade away, but then he saw the writing on the wall, so to speak, with Stalin, as he saw it, and the Soviet Union in danger, in Churchill's view, of taking over Eastern Europe, something he dreaded. And after the war, he was very, very disappointed. I think it's almost too bland a word to use, but he was very distressed about what he saw as the Soviet incursions into Eastern Europe.
And when Churchill came back to power, he was obsessed with the next nuclear weapon, the hydrogen bomb.
That was when he became prime minister. With the man's amazing energy, he got back into power. I mean, he hadn't been the most after the war. He hadn't been the greatest leader of the opposition, but he'd done a competent job, but it wasn't a great job. He spent most of his time writing his memoirs, which incidentally were notably inaccurate about the bomb, something I think would attest to the fitful attention that he paid to the project. But when he got into power, he reluctantly, and with Lindemann's assistance, he did support the British project. For a time, he thought, well, no, why don't we just piggyback on the American project? And Lindemann was absolutely appalled by Churchill's naivety. But to be fair, Churchill went along, and Britain became a nuclear power and had one of the first nuclear industries. Towards the end of his time, when Churchill really was really quite frail, he was horrified to see the power of the hydrogen bomb, and he he very much feared that it might be used in the atmosphere of the Cold War. And that was, in my opinion, one of Churchill's, you might even call it one of his finest hours again, because he really wanted an easement of the tensions in the Cold War to avoid some thermonuclear cataclysm in the mid-1950s.
What sorts of lessons can be drawn for today's leaders, do you think, from what you learned?
Well, it's always difficult to talk about history as a kind of primer for the present. But since you're inviting me to do so, you see what I mean. You know, conditions are never identical, you know. But there are certain things I would say. First of all, I think Churchill's farsightedness in looking at the nuclear age, I think that's to his great credit, that he was listening to Lindemann and others and H.G. Wells, and he was ahead of the game. And I think that's a wonderful thing for young politicians. It's not just about elbowing your way up the towards the front of the queue. It's staying aware of big issues and taking account of what science is saying. So I think he is a great example there. I do think, nonetheless, that, and this is where it's very, very difficult to draw any a unique conclusion, but I do think that even though he was, I think most people would say, a great leader at the beginning of the war, this was one area where he did take his eye off the ball and put far too much trust in one person. You see, science is about community. Nobody has the right to the last word in science. The authority comes from the community as a whole, right? And that, I don't think Churchill did understand properly. He put far too much trust in one person who was not particularly well respected by many leading academic scientists.
Well, what's interesting, you say that Lindemann had a reputation for being a great summarizer and explainer, that's because that's the level at which Churchill was comfortable with the information.
Yes,
he wasn't super sophisticated in his scientific knowledge, so he had to have someone who could kind of dumb it down for him. Is that an overstatement?
I think at the first level, that speaks well of Churchill. You do need people who are good at that, and Lindemann was good at it. The difficulty was that Lindemann's judgment an interpretation of the fact was sometimes wayward, and he had poor relations with many other people in the Churchill circle. Right, so that was where this is why, as I say, it was, in my opinion, an error to put quite so much emphasis on one person. That's my point.
And let me ask you something to go a little bit farther. Maybe I don't know if you want to or not, but the idea that, as some have said, that there are not enough scientists within government, and I guess that might go for the UK as well as in the US. There are lots of lawyers and maybe not enough scientists. Do you think there's any reason to believe that's true?
To be honest, I'm not familiar with the qualifications, if that's the right word, of, for example, the senators and members of Congress, and indeed in the UK too. I'm always pleased to see a decent proportion of scientists, but I don't think it's essential that, for example, there is some large quota of scientists. What you need is a willingness to take seriously a scientific consensus, to liaise with authoritative scientific bodies and so on. That, to me, is the really important thing. And I think that Churchill did have that. I don't think he exercised it in the right way, but nonetheless, his heart was in the right place.
Well, returning to your book for a minute, we've got a few minutes left here. How long did you spend doing research for Churchill's bomb?
Well, I guess I was in the archives for about a year and a half, but it took just a little over 5 years to write. I emerged from that book blinking into the daylight, because I was, I really spent a lot of time working at Churchill College, Cambridge, which is where I'm now based, working on the fantastic archive. I'll tell you one thing, there's a great tradition in America of these presidential libraries. I think that's a wonderful tradition. But Churchill really does set a very high standard. He kept everything, I don't think any other Churchill scholar has found any evidence of him destroying stuff. It's all there. And I think that's very much to his credit.
In the time that you spent in the archive, did anything leap out at you? Was there a specific fact or a document that you found particularly surprising?
Well, one of my favorites, one of my very favorites, was in April 1926. Now, Churchill at that time was had a very senior role in government called Chancellor of the Exchequer. He runs the country's money, so to speak. All right, and he was a really lively Chancellor of the Exchequer. I mean, it very much as we imagine him now, great speech maker. Never completely on top of his financial brief, but nonetheless, he worked hard and was a very, very well-known politician. This is before he was thrown out in the 1930s and went into the wilderness. Now, right. The thing that fascinated me was this, that in the early spring of 1926, he was at home in Chartwell working on his budget speech. This was an important budget. And you know what he did on that first Sunday morning in April 1926? He left aside his budget preparations and he dictated a summary of quantum theory.
Mm.
Right?
Right.
He was so fascinated by this new subject, which was just taking off, that he wanted to satisfy himself that he'd understood it properly. And I've read those documents. This is not just a myth. I've read his summary, and it's actually pretty good.
Wow.
That was his first known mention of the word nucleus, which is the source of that energy, you know, from where the nuclear bomb and nuclear power, that's its origin. And it's really quite a good summary. And I'm just thinking today, can you imagine the person who runs the treasury in the States, or indeed over in Britain here, taking a morning off to summarize a string theory? I mean,
and that was done only for himself? It was not intended for anyone else's eyes?
No, he did it for himself. He sent it to Lindemann to check that he'd understood the thing properly. And I'll tell you another very quick one, which was a discovery of mine, that in the great Cavendish years, when all these great discoveries, like the first verification of E equals MC squared, Einstein equation, and the discovery of the neutron, Churchill, a few months after those discoveries were made, chaired a meeting in London about those discoveries. And that's a revelation in my book. And I find that utterly amazing. Can you imagine a leading politician doing that?
No. I can't.
Amazing.
Yeah, well, Churchill seemed to had incredible interest, incredible varied interest, and tremendous energy, as you make clear in the book, too. And
I agree.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very, very much. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have asked you? Anything else you want to tell about the book? We have about a minute left.
Well, no, I just want to say that thank you for the opportunity. I think this is a remarkable story. Churchill is not normally seen as someone who had much to do with the bomb, whereas I argue in Churchill's bomb, he, more than anyone, can be seen as someone who was there right at the very beginning. Right? Early in his career, when he was in India, that was when radioactivity was discovered, a nuclear phenomenon, and he went from there to commissioning the first British hydrogen bomb. I mean, what a career. Absolutely right. Astonishing.
Yeah, long career. All right, well, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure talking to you. And again, I've been speaking with Graham Farmelow, who is the author of Churchill's Bomb, How the United States Overtook Britain in the First Nuclear Arms Race, and you can get it at Amazon and elsewhere. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Dave. Great to speak.
All right.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.